On the 22nd of January, 1879 in South Africa, the British suffered the greatest defeat ever inflicted upon them by a native African army, when a force of 1,500 was annihilated by the army of the Zulus. South Africa at the time was divided between the two British colonies of the Cape and Natal, alongside two Boer or Dutch republics, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. And the British High Commissioner, Sir Bartle Frere, had a goal of creating a single British-controlled confederation in South Africa, bringing together those four white-controlled areas into one dominion, as had just been recently achieved in Canada. There were two major obstacles to Frere's dream of a British-controlled Southern African federation. The first was the two Boer republics. The Boers, descended from Dutch and French Huguenot settlers, had trekked inland away from British rule in the 1830s, but by 1877, with the potential invasion of the Transvaal by the Zulus and a bankrupt treasury, Sir Bartle Frere offered to both bail out the Transvaal and protect it from the Zulus in return for British control. The Boers grudgingly agreed, and the British, who had historically got on well with the Zulus, applied a bit of pressure on their king, Cetshwayo, and he reined in his impis from the border. But the Zulus themselves represented the second obstacle to Frere's ambitious plans. Fiercely proud and independent, with a military structure that could easily put 30,000 well-trained warriors into the field, it was hard to comprehend how they would happily agree to British rule in a white-dominated South Africa. Moreover, Zululand was home to fine pastures, huge herds of cattle, and a labour market who could provide manpower on the European farms and in the diamond mines at Kimberley, if they weren't in Cetshwayo's army. And finally, Frere also recognised that by eliminating the Zulu threat, he could buy further goodwill for Queen Victoria's somewhat reluctant Boer subjects. So during the late 1870s, there was a subtle shift in British policy, as conducted by London's man on the ground, Sir Bartle Frere. Cetshwayo, whom the British had backed in a civil war that brought him to power, was now portrayed as a tyrant and a warmonger, a clear and present danger to the European settlers, not just in the Boer Transvaal, but in the British colony of Natal too. The Zulu king was perplexed by this new stance, and suddenly found himself being boxed into a corner that he really couldn't understand. Despite Sir Bartle Frere's new aggressive position, the British government were not keen on any sort of war, especially as they were already bogged down in a costly war in Afghanistan. Back in London, Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli ordered Frere not to seek a fight with the Zulus. This presented Frere with a problem. Any war he conducted with the Zulus would have to be done on the sly, and consequently, they would have to use only the troops that were already in South Africa for any war. The good news was that communication from Cape Town to London took about 20 days. There was a telegraph as far as the island of Madeira, and then they relied on mail ships. So if he could conduct a lightning campaign, he could present the British government with a fait accompli, and Queen Victoria with a new addition to her empire. So as this war was going to be conducted on the sly, Sir Bartle Frere and the British military commander Lord Chelmsford would have to rely on the existing British troops in South Africa, principally the 1st and 2nd battalions of the 24th Regiment of Foot, the Warwickshires, as well as the regular British forces and colonial Europeans. Over half the force would consist of local Africans formed into what was called the Natal Native Contingent, with one rifle per 10 men, and even that had horrified local white settlers who feared that today's ally could be tomorrow's well-armed enemy. The majority were simply armed with spears and shields. In fact, they looked just like Zulus, except that they wore a red bandana around their head. And with this rudimentary army in place, Frere now engineered a war with the Zulus. On the 11th of December, 1878, the Zulus were presented with an ultimatum from the British. It demanded that Cetshwayo disbanded his army, his whole military infrastructure, allow missionaries to freely preach and convert his people, and that the Zulu king would have to act on the advice of a British official, what was called a resident, who would live in his capital, effectively surrendering his total independence. And these demands were completely unacceptable to Cetshwayo, as Frere had fully intended. The Zulu king dismissed them out of hand, and when the ultimatum expired in early January 1879, Freya had his war, and the British invaded Zululand. The British commander, Lord Chelmsford, divided his invasion force into three columns, each entering Zululand from a different direction, but all sort of moving towards the Zulu capital at Ulundi. A fourth column, under Lieutenant Colonel Durnford, was held in reserve to protect Natal from any possible Zulu counterattack. And a fifth column would also protect Transvaal. The main column, number three column, was to be commanded by Chelmsford himself, and it consisted of over 4,000 men. Regular British soldiers from the 24th Regiment of Foot, white colonial soldiers, and over 2,300 members of the Natal native contingent. Keshweyo mustered his forces at his royal capital at Ulundi, and then sent them out to face all three columns. The Zulu king may have been wrong-footed by the sudden change in relations with the British, but he was acute enough to realise that on the international stage, he could rightly present himself as a victim. He also recognised that the only way to preserve Zulu independence was to defeat the British decisively and to force them to the negotiating table before any reinforcements could come. There was no better way to do that than to take out the British column commanded by Lord Chelmsford himself. And it was against number three column that Keshweyo sent the bulk of his army, something between 20 and 25,000 men. The Zulu warriors were armed with 3 to 5 foot high shields made from toughened cowhide, throwing spears, knobkerries, which were like huge clubs, and the feared assegai. This short spear had a blade that was about 18 inches long, 2 inches wide, and was deadly in close hand-to-hand combat. Many Zulus were also armed with rifles. It's estimated that over 20,000 rifles actually found their way into Zululand over the previous decade or so. Many were old obsolete muskets, but at least 500 were modern breech-loading rifles. The problem was that few Zulus had ever been trained to properly use them, and ammunition was also scarce. And in battle, most Zulus would prefer to cast aside their guns and ultimately use their assegais. Having crossed the Buffalo River at Rorke's Drift into Zululand, by the 21st of January, Chelmsford and No. 3 Column had set up a camp underneath the mountain called Isandlwana. Chelmsford sent a large reconnaissance force eastwards towards the Zulu capital, trying to spot the oncoming Zulu impi. That force, consisting of about 1,600 NNC, was commanded by Major John Dartnell. It had gone about 14 miles away when they encountered a sizeable Zulu force. With darkness descending, Dartnell couldn't get back to the camp, so he sent messages back to Chelmsford and then spent a very jittery night with his Natal native contingent in a defensive position, whilst to the east on the hills were fires lit by the watching Zulus. When Chelmsford heard the news, he decided that Dartnell had met the advance party of the Zulu army. And in his keen desire to smash the Zulus as fast as possible, he decided to march out without delay. And before dawn, 3:30, on Wednesday the 22nd of January, he moved out with about half of his column, 1,100 men. He left 1,200 men under Lieutenant Colonel Pullin, with orders to strike camp later that day and follow him, bringing as much ammunition as possible for the battle that was going to happen to the east. He also ordered No. 2 Column under Colonel Anthony Durnford, which was at the border at Rorke's Drift, to move up to Isandlwana. It never occurred to Chelmsford that the camp itself would be attacked. In fact, his biggest concern was the Zulus wouldn't meet him in battle at all and would adopt a guerrilla hit-and-run campaign, which would not give him and Freya that decisive victory they needed before the government back in London found out what they were up to. But Chelmsford had made a fatal error. Not only had he divided his army in enemy territory without actually knowing where the enemy were, but the forces that had been seen by Dartnell were a clever decoy. The Zulus had brilliantly managed to move 25,000 men over the hills unobserved and were now lying silently in a valley just a few miles north of the camp at Isandlwana. Wednesday the 22nd of January dawned. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Pullin was the 40-year-old son of a parson from near Thirsk in Yorkshire, and the grandson of a colonel in the Scots Greys. Graduating from Sandhurst Military Academy in 1855, he'd built a reputation as a solid administrator in the army, who in his 24 years of service had never seen command in a combat situation. And he wasn't expected to command a combat situation on this day either. Once again, the army was heading off to fight the Zulus, and he was being left to do what he did best, organise the supplies to move forward as soon as possible. Not only was he not expecting a fight, but he could be forgiven for being slightly complacent. Not only was the Zulu army, after all, to the east, but his command consisted of 1,200 men, 2 7-pound artillery pieces, and over 1 million rounds of ammunition. More than enough to take on any comers, surely. So he must have been somewhat disturbed when around 7 a.m, whilst the camp were having breakfast, a scout came in from the plateau to the north of the camp, reporting large parties of Zulus in that vicinity. This news was brought by a Lieutenant Vereker, who actually appears in the film Zulu Dawn. His character is played by Simon Ward. Although most of the Vereker story in the film is just that, a story. By now, Zulus had appeared on the skyline on the plateau. Nowhere near large enough to attack the camp, but puzzling nevertheless, seeing as Chelmsford was supposed to be engaging with them all to the east. Unbeknownst to Pauline, this was the 70-year-old commander of the Zulu army who had run with his men all the way from Ulundi, and he was scouting the camp in preparation for an attack at dawn the following day. The Zulus, having scouted, then disappeared. Just after 10 a.m, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Durnford and 500 mounted soldiers cantered into the camp. Durnford's orders had been to march to the camp at once with all the forces he had. He was somewhat puzzled to find that there were no further orders when he arrived at the camp. Durnford was senior in rank to Pauline, and afterwards many argued that he was actually therefore in command of the camp. However, this would have actually meant combining number 3 column and number 2 column, and no specific orders had actually been issued for this to happen. With further reports coming in of still large numbers of Zulus up on the plateau, Durnford came to the conclusion that the Zulus were attempting to encircle Chelmsford to the east, and he decided to take his column out to prevent that encirclement happening. About an hour after he had arrived, Durnford was on the move again. His decision to leave the camp has been, as I say, a source of debate and controversy ever since. At about the same time, 11:30 in the morning, up on the Nakuta Heights, the plateau, Lieutenant Rohr was scouting, and he rode to the edge of a ravine and peered over and couldn't believe his eyes. There, sitting silently, were 20,000 Zulus. Upon being discovered, the Zulu army, without any orders from their superiors, rose and started to form their battle formations, the charging bull buffalo. The right wing, which will go round to the north side of the camp, the left wing, which will go out across the plateau and will run into Colonel Durnford as he was riding towards Chelmsford. Pauline formed his men along the north and northeast sides of the camp, about a mile and a half out from the camp. This was a massive sort of defensive position to try and hold, with just 6 companies of British regular soldiers and 1 contingent of the NNC. And don't forget, they only had 1 rifle for every 10 men. Historian Ian Knight estimates that the soldiers in the British companies were actually standing about 3 yards away from each other, which makes it a very thin British red line indeed. Nevertheless, these were experienced soldiers. Many had been in the army for over 10 years, they were in their 30s, most had combat experience, and there was no sign of panic, despite the size of the army that was advancing upon them. In fact, many thought of what great luck. They thought they had been left behind while the Chelmsford had gone off to fight the main army, and it was them who were going to get the action. The 15,000 main chest of the Zulu army descended off the heights, and at 600 yards, the British opened fire. The steady volley fire, 3 rounds a minute, had a devastating effect on the Zulus opposite them, and the attack started to falter. Meanwhile, on the spur to the north of the camp, E and F companies were firing away at a force of Zulus who were about 800 yards away. But rather than turning to engage the British, this force just kept moving behind Isandhlwana Hill. To the east, Chelmsford, alerted by the sounds of cannon fire, asked a naval officer, Lieutenant Milne, to climb a nearby hill and look at the camp through his naval telescope. All Milne could see was the tents, and cattle being herded into camp, all of which looked like it was under control. But actually what was happening was the cattle weren't being herded by the British, but were fleeing from the oncoming Zulus. Back at Isandlwana, it was approaching 1:30 p.m. and suddenly lots of things started to happen all at once, very quickly. Out on the plain, facing the Zulu left horn, Durnford was running out of ammunition. Seeing their predicament, Lieutenant Pope, the monocled officer commanding G Company of the 2nd Battalion, 24th Foot, moved off the line to close the gap with Durnford and provide covering fire for him. But at that very moment, Durnford's mounted men withdrew, leaving G Company horribly exposed. Meanwhile, the Zulu regiments forming the chest of the charging bull were still being pinned down by the volley fire of the British along with the artillery fire. It was at this moment that a brave Zulu Induna, or chief, arrived from up on the plateau. A chief from the Bayela people, in his early 40s, wearing a leopardskin collar and wearing a huge headdress made from long feathers of a crane. He seemed almost immune to the British bullets as he paced up and down in front of the warriors. Looking down at them as they sought cover, he raised his voice above the din of the battle and shouted, "The little branch of leaves," which was the name for the king, "gave no such order as this." And upon hearing those words, with a roar, the Zulus rose and charged. And in that very moment, the inspirational Induna was shot through the head. In that initial charge made by the Zulu chest, Pope's company exposed out on the, who had been trying to cover Durnford, were annihilated. Seeing the Zulus annihilating redcoats, the NNC, armed mainly with spears, fled in terror. At that same time, the Zulu right wing, which had moved unobserved around Isandlwana Mountain, now entered the camp from the rear. Pauline ordered the bugler to recall the men to the camp. This battle was fast turning into a rout. Small groups of soldiers standing back to back using their last bullets and then their bayonets, fighting to the very end. In the unfolding calamity, Pauline asked an officer, Lieutenant Melville, to carry the Queen's colour to safety. Together with another officer, Lieutenant Coghill, he galloped out of the camp. Back in the camp, it was chaos. Zulu reports later record British soldiers fighting with their bare fists and Zulus in a killing frenzy, slashing at anything that moved, in horses, cattle, even camp dogs. The orderly of the naval officer with the telescope, Lieutenant Milne, had been left in the camp, and he stood with his back to a wagon, clenching a naval cutlass and challenging, beckoning the Zulus to take him on. Like some sort of gladiator, he dispatched his enemies one at a time until one Zulu crawled under the wagon and speared him from behind. As the battle reached its zenith, the scene became even more hellish as the sun entered a partial eclipse and a weird darkness descended on Isandlwana. Meanwhile, above the mayhem in the camp, C Company, commanded by Lieutenant Younghusband, retreated along the slopes of Isandlwana itself above the carnage. The Zulus blocked their further retreat, and when the men of C Company ran out of ammunition, Younghusband took his sword and led them in a brave but futile bayonet charge down the hill. Terrified survivors fled the battlefield down a rough trail towards the Buffalo River and the safety of Natal. Through thorn bushes, boggy ground with Zulus chasing them, among them were Lieutenants Coghill and Melville trying to save the Queen's colour. Having run that terrifying 7-mile gauntlet called Fugitive's Trail, they found the river in full flood, and any man not on a horse was killed by the Zulus there. And it was there, at Fugitive's Drift, that the exhausted Melville and Coghill were overtaken on the Natal side of the river by the Zulus and killed. Unfortunately for fans of Zulu Dawn, Lieutenant Vereker was not with them, although another colonial officer called Higginson was. He managed to get away. Vereker, by the way, was killed at the main battle. It was also at the river that Private Samuel Wassell of the 80th Regiment, but serving with a colonial mounted unit, won the Victoria Cross by returning under fire to rescue Private Westwood, who was floundering in the swirling waters. The Battle of Isandlwana was over by 2 p.m. It was less than 3.5 hours since Roar had discovered the Zulu army in that ravine. Not a single man on foot escaped with his life. Only 55 Europeans escaped at all from that bloodbath, only 5 of which were officers from the regular British army. Included in that number was a Lieutenant Smith Dorian, who would go on to command the 2nd Corps at the retreat from Mons during the First World War. Just one lone British soldier survived on the battlefield against the whole victorious Zulu army. One unknown member of young husband's company hadn't charged down the hill with his officer, but had made his way up the steep slope of the mountain, and there he'd holed himself up in a small cave and took pot shots at any Zulu who came anywhere near him. Eventually the Zulus got tired of this annoying British soldier and brought up men with captured rifles from the battlefield who proceeded to fire several volleys into the cave. Zulu stories say that he was killed when the shadows were starting to get long on the ground, which would suggest that he had actually held the Zulus at bay for probably a couple of hours, hoping against all hopes for relief. Maybe he could even see 3 miles away Chelmsford's column gathering to return. Since Naval Officer Lieutenant Milne had looked at the camp, Chelmsford had been receiving more urgent and desperate reports from the camp, and had decided to ride back to Isandhlwana to see what on earth was going on. On the way, he met an officer called Lonsdale, who relayed a shocking story. Lonsdale had been with Chelmsford's Parsi in the east, but had been sent back to Isandhlwana having suffered a fall and the effects of sunstroke. He was in a bit of a daze as his horse wandered into the camp, sort of on homing device. And as he came to and focused, he became aware there were Zulus milling around the camp, wearing red British tunics and holding bloody assegais. He turned his horse and spurred it into a gallop. Some Zulus gave chase, but their efforts were half-hearted. They were exhausted, and quite frankly, there was loot to be had in the camp. His news shocked Chelmsford, who urgently called his very disparate forces in the east to come together and return to Isandhlwana camp. It was nightfall before Chelmsford re-entered the camp. Bodies lay everywhere in the dark. Many of the British soldiers had been ritually disemboweled by the Zulus, who believed that dead warriors' spirits needed to be released, or the stomach would puff up with gas, and instead of ascending to heaven, the spirit of the warrior would haunt the man who'd killed him. The British, unaware of this custom, believed that their comrades had been tortured, and that belief would result in some vicious reprisals, not least the killing of Zulu wounded found at the relief of Rorke's Drift the following day. Of the camp that Chelmsford had left that morning, nothing was left. It had been thoroughly looted, and 1,500 men, 700 British soldiers, 700 members of the Natal Native Contingent, 100 colonial troops or civilians had been massacred. It wasn't until later in the year that the British returned to bury their dead, and the cairns marking their resting places are littered across the battlefield to this day. Only one British soldier was brought back to Britain for burial, Lieutenant Edgar Anstey. The 28-year-old, born in Adelaide in South Australia, is buried in St John's Churchyard in Woking. Not only is he the only British soldier to have been brought back from Isandhlwana to Britain, but he's the first Australian-born soldier to die in action outside of Australia. The slow communications that Sir Bartle Frere and Chelmsford had hoped to use as a cover for their war now delayed the news of the disaster heading back to Britain. It was around midnight on the 10th, 11th of February that news finally reached London, and Britain went into a state of shock. The plucky defence of the mission station at Rorke's Drift was poor compensation for the magnitude of the defeat at Isandhlwana. Whilst playing up the gallantry of the defenders of Rorke's Drift, not least with the number of VCs that were awarded, Chelmsford was quick to lay the blame for the defeat at Isandhlwana on anybody but himself. But equally, it couldn't be the fate of red-coated infantry. So rather than Pullen being held to account for spreading his troops out too thinly, 3 myths were planted as to who was to blame. The NNC collapsed at a crucial moment in the battle, Durnford didn't take command, and the Commissariat delayed ammunition supplies by quibbling and with a lack of screwdrivers to open the boxes up. Not only do these myths not all stand up to scrutiny and also obscure Chelmsford's culpability in dividing his forces and Pullen's decision to spread his line too thinly and not to create any entrenched positions, it ignores something far more important: that the modern British army had been outmaneuvered and outfought by an enemy with spears and shields. The Zulus had successfully fooled Chelmsford into dividing his forces with that decoy move. They had moved 25,000 men undetected to the north of the camp and then they had delivered a Horns of the Buffalo attack over a 4-mile front. And finally, despite the withering fire laid down by experienced British redcoats, the Zulu warriors had held their nerve and had pressed home their attack, inspired by the chief from the Baiila people. Indeed, if there was a hero at Isandhlwana, I would argue that it wasn't a British one, but that chief, who, resplendent in his leopard skin coat and crane feather headdress, inspired his warriors in one final charge against that withering British rifle fire. Maybe without his urgings, the Zulu attack could have completely faltered and petered out. History turns on very small hinges, doesn't it? The Zulu victory at Isandhlwana came at a heavy price. Over 1,000 of Keshweyo's crack troops had died. And as the Zulu king lamented, an assegai has been plunged into the Zulu nation. The shocking defeat of the British did have a silver lining for Chelmsford and Sabartal Frere, however. Isandhlwana had been a disaster, a national humiliation. And now, troops would be found to restore Britannia's honour. With this new stronger army made up of British regular troops, not local forces, Chelmsford was able to reinvade Zululand, and on the 4th of July 1879, less than 6 months after the defeat at Isandhlwana, he delivered a devastating defeat on the Zulu army outside their capital of Ulundi. King Keshweyo was captured, Zululand was subjugated, and on the fields of Zululand lay over 7,000 warriors who died defending their homeland and the old Zulu order.
Well, thanks for joining me today, and I hope you enjoyed that story from the Anglo-Zulu Wars. Plenty more coming your way, including the Battle of Rorke's Drift, very soon. And if you enjoy my work, then please click the Support the Show button below, or indeed visit my website, thehistorychap.com. I am Chris Green, The History Chap. Thanks for listening. Keep well, and I'll chat to you again very soon.